Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an analysis of the increasing risk of war between Russia and Ukraine and the rising cost to Russia of its annexation of Crimea. Daniel Serwa, a former U.S. Special Envoy for Yugoslavia who participated in the Dayton peace talks, joins us to discuss Putin's use of NATO intervention in the former Yugoslavia as justification for annexing Crimea and look into the mounting costs for Russia of taking on Crimea and possibly eastern Ukraine, as well as the cost to the U.S. and Europe of taking on what's left of Ukraine that has been looted economically and is deeply in debt. Then we'll look into the Obama administration's second attempt to crack down on for-profit colleges, who account for 13% of college enrollment but incur half of all federal student loan debts. David Halperin, a senior fellow at Republic Report, where he has an article, Shame, Wall Street Journal compares rule for predatory colleges to Obamacare, joins us to discuss the gainful employment rule that will set rules to stop the misleading promises and expensive advertising by the for-profit college industry, which is paid for with taxpayer dollars, used to attract veterans and minority students, many of whom end up with worthless diplomas while being saddled for life with onerous debt. Then finally, on the 25th anniversary of the Exxon Valdez oil spill in Alaska, we'll speak with Shannon Moore, a progressive radio broadcaster in Anchorage, Alaska. She joins us to discuss the toxic legacy from millions of gallons of crude oil that fouled the pristine Prince William Sound, damaging more than 1,300 miles of shoreline and destroying the local fishing industry. We'll examine the likelihood of more oil spills as drilling is underway in the Arctic north of Alaska, where it will be all but impossible to clean up a spill in that challenging and remote environment. And joining me now is Daniel Serwa, who served as U.S. Special Envoy and Coordinator for the Bosnian Federation, mediating between Croats and Muslims from 1994 to 1996, and he participated in negotiations in the first agreement reached at the Dayton peace talks. He was also Vice President for Centers of Peacebuilding Innovation at the United States Institute of Peace, and is now a professor at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies. He also blogs at peacefair.net. Welcome to Background Briefing, Daniel Serwa.
My pleasure to be here.
And in terms of the confrontation between Russia and the West over Ukraine, having just annexed Crimea, and now a very real credible possibility that Russia will invade eastern Ukraine, obviously Putin in his speech recently to the Duma used Kosovo as an example of the West's double standard. Since you were involved in both the Bosnian War and later in what happened with Kosovo, you had something of an inside, a ringside seat there. What are the connections or analogies put forward by Putin and many of those who support Putin's position in the West?
Putin is trying to claim that he's entered Crimea to protect Russian speakers, but there's really very little merit in that claim. There have been virtually no mistreatment of Russian speakers in Crimea, and certainly nothing like the ethnic cleansing and killing that caused the NATO bombing of Yugoslavia.
And is there a possibility, though, that now that he's taken over Crimea, apparently key people like parliamentarians and the leading military officer have been disappeared along with a bunch of activists?
I think there's a very real risk that Putin, who's been playing this from Milosevic's playbook, will proceed to the next stage. And the next stage is for him to try to get rid of some of the Ukrainian speakers, and in particular the Tatars, who represent a threat to his hold on Crimea. So I don't think this is entirely over in Crimea, and I think there's some real risk of that we're going to see much worse behavior on the part of Moscow.
But apparently, I've talked to a number of people who were in Moscow at the time of the bombing of Milosevic and Serbia, And apparently there was genuine outrage amongst the Russian people. They really had.
Well, I think that's absolutely true, that there was genuine outrage. At the time, there was very little genuine outrage at the mistreatment of the Albanians, so it was a rather one-sided kind of outrage. And frankly, Russia, in the end, by allowing Resolution 1244 to pass, which ended the NATO-Yugoslavia war, de facto it approved the NATO intervention. It wasn't a legal approval, but it certainly surrendered its right to stand against what NATO did.
But Putin has cited this. Obviously, he just did so a few days ago at the Duma. He's also talked about how he felt that Russia got had over approving the UN resolution to intervene in Libya, which he felt NATO took advantage of, and that began his falling out with Medvedev, his protege. So, I mean, it's clear that Putin harbors these grudges, whether he's doing it for political purposes and for propaganda purposes, but it wouldn't work unless the Russian people felt this similar sense of humiliation that he articulates.
I think that's absolutely correct. It wouldn't work except for the populist support that it engenders. I think there's much more basis in historical fact for Putin's complaint about NATO behavior in Libya than there is about his claim that he's doing in Crimea what NATO did in Kosovo. If he really believed that, the logical consequence would be that Russia would recognize the independence of Kosovo, which it's certainly not preparing to do.
Again, I'm speaking with Daniel Serwer, who served as U.S. Special Envoy and Coordinator for the Bosnian Federation, mediating between Croats and Muslims from 1994 to 1996, and he participated in negotiations in the first agreement reached at the Dayton peace talks. He also was the Vice President for Centers of Peace Building Innovation at the United States Institute of Peace, and he is now a professor at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies, and he also blogs at peacefair.net. Now, it seems that, obviously there's this vote coming up now in Ukraine in May 25th, which is a key vote. And I spoke yesterday to a independent defense analyst in Moscow who believes that there's an 80% chance that Putin will invade. He put it at sometime around April the 15th. While Ukraine is weak and in disarray, he feels that Putin's going to strike. The last thing that Putin's going to accept is this election coming up in May that would permanently sever Ukraine from the Russian orbit. What's your sense on whether or not that's going to happen?
I think there's a good chance that it will happen. The big immediate problem Putin has created for himself by taking Crimea is that he's removed something like 1 million pro-Russian votes from the national polls in Ukraine. So it seems to me that the logic of the situation is that he should want to take more of Russian-speaking Ukraine, while, as you say, the Ukrainians are very weak. And it'll be a real test of NATO, of Europe, and of the United States to see whether they can find non-military ways, because I don't think there is any military way, to deter the Russians from moving against southern Ukraine, where, you know, the Russian interest is clearly not in the Russian speakers, but in the heavy industry, much of which works for Russian military manufacturing that happens to be located there.
So if Putin goes ahead with this, it obviously could end up as a major disaster. Presumably, he wants to repeat what he did in Crimea, where he can take a chunk of territory without firing a shot, in effect. It's not likely to work out quite so smoothly if he takes a big chunk of eastern Ukraine. And, you know, at that point, all bets are off, aren't they? I mean, this would be... What's your sense?
My sense is still that the West is not prepared and will not intervene directly militarily because it would be a very difficult intervention indeed. I think you're exactly correct that the Russians will face serious problems if they invade southern Ukraine. There are a lot of Ukrainians there. There are a lot of people who will resist. Crimea is actually quite unique in Ukraine in the degree of its allegiance to Russia, partly because it was part of Russia until 1954. That's not true of southern Ukraine, and I think he'd have a much more difficult time there. It won't be taken without a shot fired.
But if, obviously one's not suggesting the West go to war, because Russia has a substantial nuclear arsenal, and Ukraine is not a member of NATO. But it would seem, if you follow this through, that Putin, whether he's trying to distract the Russian people from his own kleptocracy and using patriotism, as, you know, this country went crazy over invading Iraq, the press and everybody drank the Kool-Aid, and national patriotic fervor was a high pitch in the United States prior to the invasion of Iraq that turned out to be one of the great political disasters in history, or geopolitical disasters in history. So you can't, obviously what's going on in Russia now is similar. But I take it, though, that at the end of the day, this is going to probably cost Putin and Russia a lot more than they'll gain if they get bogged down in a guerrilla war in Ukraine, if they take on the burden of Crimea without having the tourist revenue coming in there, and then if the Europeans wean themselves from Russian oil and gas, isn't at the end of the day Putin going to be the big loser?
Yes, but in the long term, of course, we're all dead. I think you're exactly right that Crimea will be more of a burden than the Russians anticipate right now. I think southern Ukraine would be an enormous burden to them and would cause a very dramatic reaction in Europe and in the United States. So, yes, Putin risks biting off far more than he can chew, but he wouldn't be the first leader to make a mistake as a result of domestic enthusiasm for what he was doing.
Well, that raises the question of the extent to which, as Angela Merkel said, he's not in the real world. That's what I find disturbing about this, is that he's...
Well, I would agree entirely. He seems to believe the propaganda of the Russian state-controlled media, in particular about the mistreatment of Russians in Ukraine. There's very little evidence for it at the moment. Admittedly, there have been some clashes, there have been some demonstrations that might cause a Russian speaker some concern, but there have been quite a few that might cause a Ukrainian speaker some concern as well. So it seems to me he has to be somebody among his advisors should be saying to them, look, you've done something that we can be happy with. Let's not overdo it. But he may overdo it. As I say, he wouldn't be the first leader to be carried away by the enthusiasm of his own population.
Well, one of his chief aides just the other day, referring to Putin as the boss, as they call him, said, in terms of Western sanctions against Putin and Russia, this aide said, you don't back the boss into a corner. That's a bad idea. That was his warning. Well, now the G7 have basically said that they're not going to go to the G8 conference in Sochi. So already they're putting Putin out in the cold. And Russia, again, is acting defiantly, so sanctions don't, water off the duck's back, if you will. So the attitudes, seem to be that the more that the West pushes back, the more Putin hardens his position.
Well, that's not a reason not to push back, however. Putin, so far as the G8 is concerned, has been a pretty useless affair all along. Even the G7 is pretty useless. The G20 is where important economic things happen today. They're using the G7 right now to send a message to Moscow, but I think much more important than G7, G8 is a consistent policy of strong support for the government in Kiev and getting them past this immediate crisis. They need to get to their election, and in order for that to happen, somehow the Europeans and the Americans have to send a strong enough signal to Putin that biting off southern Ukraine would be a serious mistake. I'm not entirely sure how you do that, but it does appear to me that in the long term, it's pretty clear that Russia will not benefit from taking anything more than Crimea. Even with Crimea, I don't expect the Americans or the Europeans ever to accept the annexation of Crimea. And that means that we face a long period of sanctions and other measures to try to correct the situation.
Again, I'm speaking with Daniel Serwer, who served as U.S. Special Envoy and Coordinator for the Bosnian Federation, mediating between Croats and Muslims from 1994 to 1996, and he participated in negotiations in the first agreement reached at the Dayton peace talks. He also was the Vice President for Centers of Peace Building Innovation at the United States Institute of Peace, and he is now a professor at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies, and he also blogs at peacefair.net. Well, we've dealt with the extent to which Putin, his victories may be short-lived, that Crimea may end up being a burden, and that it may also get ugly with ethnic cleansing against the Tatars, etc. And if he bites off eastern and southern Ukraine, then that may prove to be even more expensive. But on the other side, if the West is going to prop up and save Ukraine that's been looted by Putin's protege Yanukovych, then that's going to be a massive financial drain. I mean, they're broke, what, something like $80 billion in debt or something? I don't know.
Absolutely. Ukraine is going to be a big burden for the West. The IMF is already over quota. That is, it's loaned Ukraine more than it's supposed to already, and it's going to have to loan Ukraine more. The Europeans, who are fed up with basket cases because of Greece and Portugal and other problems they've had within the Eurozone, the Europeans aren't feeling generous, but they will do what they can. And the Americans, the legislation for some loan guarantees, last I heard, was still stalled in the Congress. So this is going to be a challenge, meeting the needs of Ukraine over the next couple of years, no matter how big or small Ukraine may be. It's going to be a burden. It's going to be a burden for Russia, and it's going to be a burden for the West. Be much better if we could come to some agreement that we'd all cooperate rather than compete. But I don't see any prospect of that at the moment.
Well, you were just telling me earlier, Daniel Serwer, that you're just back from Cuba, where that's been 50 or 60 years of how many presidents has Castro outlived? I can't remember that.
Well, he's outlived half a dozen presidents, but it's not quite 70 or 80 years.
No.
It's 55 years, I think, is the right count. But it's a Cuba, you know, I wanted to get there before communism fell, and I almost didn't make it. It's a very different Cuba from what it was a couple of decades ago. It's a Cuba that is running on a, mostly now on a convertible currency, which is driving a tremendous growth of entrepreneurialism and the private sector. The withering away of the state is happening, but it's not withering away towards some communist utopia. It's withering away under pressure from the Cubans' own capitalist instincts, which are very, very strong.
Well, I brought it up because I wanted to get a sense of, in terms of your work, in terms of peace building, is there at this point when things look so bleak, and the idea, I don't know whether you read the op-ed in Monday's New York Times by the former U.N. ambassador to Russia, Michael McFaul, it's very bleak that we're entering a new Cold War, not the same as the old one, but, you know, if there was ever a relic of the Cold War, it's Cuba.
Certainly, Cuba is a relic of the Cold War. It's a state-controlled economy. Is that Fidel and Raul are ideologically relics of the Cold War? But frankly, I don't think there's any prospect that Cuba will survive. I think it's much more likely that there'll be a transition of some sort. The question is whether it's going to be an orderly one or a disorderly one. I don't think Russia's going to come in and save communist Cuba from the inevitable. Venezuela's been doing that in recent years, but Venezuela can't do it much longer either. So, you know, I think there, too, we're looking at something that... be careful what you wish for, because Cuba may end up being a big burden for the United States someday.
So just in closing then, back to, I brought Cuba up to suggest that if there's some optimism in terms of change in Cuba, there seems to be little to no optimism for change in Russia. It seems to be changing for the worse.
It is changing for the worse. It's not going back, however, to Soviet-style communism. It's very much a kind of crony capitalist society, and that's a fate that doesn't help countries to survive in the modern world. So, you know, as much as I dislike what Putin is up to, do I really think that he can restore some kind of one-party rule in Russia? Well, that will be up to Russians. He's certainly going to try, but I have my doubts that he's going to succeed.
Well, thank you very much for joining us here today, Daniel Sower.
My pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Daniel Sower, who served as U.S. Special Envoy and Coordinator for the Bosnian Federation, mediating between Croats and Muslims from 1994 to 1996, and he participated in negotiating the first agreement reached in the Dayton peace talks. He's also was the Vice President for Centers of Peacebuilding Innovation at the United States Institute of Peace, and is now a professor at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies, and he also blogs at peacefair.net. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the Obama administration's second attempt to crack down on for-profit colleges.
From Russia with love, I fly to you, much wiser since my goodbye.
Attention.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is David Halperin, a senior fellow at Republic Report. He was previously founding director of Campus Progress and a senior vice president at the Center for American Progress, senior policy advisor for Howard Dean's presidential campaign, founding executive director of the American Constitution Society, White House speechwriter and special assistant for national security affairs to President Bill Clinton, and counsel to the Senate Intelligence Committee. He has an article at Republic Report, Shame, Wall Street Journal Compares Rule for Predatory Colleges to Obamacare. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Halperin.
Thank you, Ian. How are you?
Pretty good. And we've spoken quite a number of times over the years about this for-profit college racket, as I call it, where they're just 13% of college enrollments are accounted for by the for-profit college industry, yet they are responsible for almost half of all federal student loan defaults. I suppose it shouldn't be entirely surprising that the Wall Street Journal, their editorial board, made this misleading comparison between the president's efforts to set this new rule. But they also, there was an editorial that you mentioned earlier, an op-ed, to set this new gainful employment rule. But there was an op-ed prior to that by former Senator Bob Kerry, also supporting the for-profit college industry. So how do you explain that? I thought he was supposed to be one of the good guys.
Well, I can explain it this way, the same way I can explain why anyone supports these for-profit colleges that are ripping off students money. Bob Kerry took campaign donations from his co-author of the Wall Street Journal article opposing regulation of for-profit colleges. That's Jeffrey Leeds, who the article did not disclose, owns for-profit colleges, sits on the board of the second biggest for-profit college, EDMC, sits on the board of the Trade Association for For-Profit Colleges, APSCU, and Bob Kerry runs his own experimental online higher education business. So they're both in this industry, and that explains that. I must say, though, I'm surprised that the Wall Street Journal is in favor of no accountability for for-profit colleges. For-profit colleges is basically a federal program, gets 90% of its funding from taxpayers. And the issue is, should we be holding them accountable for waste, fraud, and abuse? Should we be making sure that the federal investment is actually used to help people rather than hurt people? But the reason that the Wall Street Journal is against accountability for this industry is because the money being made by this industry often is Wall Street money. Goldman Sachs owns 41% of that same for-profit college, EDMC. Wells Fargo owns a big chunk of another of the very poorly performing for-profit colleges, Corinthian. So it's really about not less government, and it's not about accountability. It's about big profits for some firms that are engaging in waste, fraud, and abuse with our tax dollars.
Well, it seems to be not so much about big government, but about how you can, in the private sector, under the guise of free enterprise, you can use government to basically become a private piggy bank and write your own ticket and make a ton of money and not have to perform.
That's exactly right. The fastest way to easy money is through automatic payments, basically, from taxpayers. And that's why you see this industry so up in arms trying to fight President Obama from issuing a rule that would hold them accountable, because their really only game is having a favorable regulatory environment. They're not actually competing to help students and provide a quality product. They're competing to see if they can fool students, not be held accountable for their misstatements, and they can offer, spend very little on instruction, spend a lot on marketing, and leave students with low-quality education, poor reputation of their degrees, and very high prices, and therefore they're all deep in debt. So the only way that they're going to survive most of these schools, some of the schools are good, but most of them, big ones, are doing very poorly. The only way they can survive is by taking a big chunk of their riches that they get from taxpayers and turning around and using it to try to buy Washington to keep their favored position. And that's true of a number of industries I've seen that suck off the federal teat, but this one is the worst, the worst.
And again, I'm speaking with David Halperin, who's a senior fellow at Republic Report. He was previously founding director of Campus Progress and senior vice president at the Center for American Progress, senior policy advisor for Howard Dean's presidential campaign, founding executive director of the American Constitution Society, White House speechwriter and special assistant for national security affairs to President Clinton and counsel to the Senate Intelligence Committee. And he has an article at Republic Report, Shame, Wall Street Journal compares rule for predatory colleges to Obamacare. Now, we're talking about this for-profit college industry that takes about $26 billion in money from the federal government in the form of student loans and about $10 billion in federal Pell grants. And so that's $36 billion. That's not small change. And this rule is trying to stop them from overpromising with these advertising blitzes they do. And hardly a day goes by, David Halpern, without some new college that comes out of nowhere with a shingle, with a glossy commercial. I mean, the most egregious of all, by the way, was the recent commercial by the University of Phoenix that was trying to play on the success of the Academy Award-winning movie Gravity, where you can go to the University of Phoenix and end up being an astronaut. And there's the woman, you know, the graduate of Phoenix putting on her helmet, just like Sandra Bullock.
Yep. I mean, people do come out of these schools and do well. There are good teachers in these schools. There are good students. Some people find, I mean, what these schools are offering in contrast to our beleaguered public education system is more flexibility. You can study online. There are more classes at night. And they're actually doing more to train for careers. And part of the reason these schools have filled a vacuum is precisely because we didn't invest in public universities doing those things. It's too much focus on, you know, the academic side of higher ed and not enough on career training. But unfortunately, we didn't set up rules that would make sure that the people who got into this would behave honestly. And so what we've had is what you call a race to the bottom. The more you abuse students, the more money you make. All we need to do is flip that, make the rules tougher, make the schools have to perform. Then maybe we could have some promise in for-profit education, and maybe that would help spur the other sectors to get more serious about doing this. But even if a lot of these schools shut down, as you say, it's over $30 billion a year. We could take some of that money and invest in our community colleges, our high schools, in apprenticeships, and other ways to do what we need to do, which is to help people raise up veterans and single moms and immigrants and other people and help them to train for careers that will help them support their families. That's all these people are trying to do, and instead they're getting screwed by cynical Wall Street fat cats that are laughing all the way to the bank with this money and then turning around when Obama tries to regulate them and saying, this is more Obamacare, this is government overreach, you're philosophically opposed to private sector, you're socialist. All of these attacks were made, or that you're in league with the Wall Street short sellers who are betting against the industry. And the people they use, that they hire to try to make these arguments, are the fanciest, most expensive people you might imagine, from Susie Orman to Colin Powell to Trent Lott to Dick Gephardt. They have co-opted people, bought them into this industry, and had them vouch for it. They've got the money to do it, and it misleads people, and it's in doing a huge disservice.
Yeah, but it's yours and my money. It's the taxpayers' money. I mean, that's what I find extraordinary about this, that this rule will stop all these over-advertising and over-promising, which is being done with taxpayer money. You know, the federal government has various injunctions against advertising about itself. The USAID, for example, or Voice of America, and all of these U.S. government agencies that try to spread the American message around the world, they're not allowed to show any of their films and television inside the United States. No government agency is allowed to make advertisements about themselves and what a great job they do. But this taxpayer-funded industry is able to go and spend enormous amounts of money on television to get these kids to enroll in these companies, many of which have just sprung up overnight.
Well, fewer of them are springing up overnight now because people are getting tougher. I think more students are aware that these schools can be a bad deal. They're voting with their feet in their pocketbooks. Enrollment is down. The share prices are down. And now you have, in addition to the President Obama and the Department of Education cracking down with the regulation, you have over 30 state attorneys general investigating many of these big schools for fraud and deception. You have finally the federal enforcement agencies, the Justice Department, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, the Federal Trade Commission, the Security Exchange Commission, all of which are implicated by the fraudulent conduct of this industry, are now stepping up, investigating. So things are changing, and it is going to be tougher to be dishonest, but only if we stick to it, because these schools are not giving up. They're continuing to spend money to lobby and enlist the Wall Street Journal and the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and the American Legislative Exchange Council and all these giant pieces of the corporate, the special interest lobby to try to help them continue to do their bidding. And again, they have the cash to do it. But this is the time for Americans to tune into this issue and speak out. They can write to the Department of Education now and say that there should be accountability for these schools. I've got an e-book coming out next week, on a week from today, 100 pages about this issue called Stealing America's Future, and I hope people will read that, because I've really tried to go into detail about how students' lives are ruined by this industry and how lobbyists take money cynically to continue to spread the lies of this industry.
Well, I think not that I'm attracted to this subject, David, but the reason I keep reminding our audience about this egregious ripoff of taxpayer money is that it gets to the heart of the Washington corruption, which is a bipartisan phenomenon. You've got people like Representative Alcee Hastings, a former disbarred federal judge, Democrat down in Florida, Rob Andrews, who's they've been given tons of money. You've pointed this out in your article. Then on the Republican side, you've got John Boehner, John Klein, you've got Virginia Fox from North Carolina, and Representative Vern Buchanan is also under ethics review. So what they do is they buy politicians on both sides with taxpayer money, fly them around in private jets, and this is really more about Washington corruption, is it not? I mean, it's just the sad part about it is that the people who really need a leg up, minority students and vets, are the ones that are getting abused in this situation.
Well, they bring students, the for-profit colleges find some students and offer them all expenses paid trips and hand them talking points and tell them, don't talk about debt, tell them what a wonderful school it is. When we tried to bring a few students, and we don't have a lot of money, our coalition of civil rights and consumer and veterans groups, we don't have a lot of money to bring students to D.C., but when we did bring them, we couldn't get any members of Congress to see them, ones who said their lives had been ruined. But Senator Tom Harkin had hearings. He had students testify. So some of the voices of students and also former staff, who also call me, by the way, almost every day to tell me horror stories about the cynical nature of these institutions, there are some things happening. There is some pressure from real people whose lives have been negatively impacted. But yes, it is insulting that our tax dollars are used to lobby to continue to misuse our tax dollars.
Well, David Halpern, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Well, it's a pleasure. Thank you, Ian. I appreciate it.
Again, I've been speaking with David Halpern, who's a senior fellow at Republic Report. He was previously founding director of Campus Progress and senior vice president at the Center for American Progress, senior policy advisor for Howard Dean's presidential campaign, founding executive director of the American Constitution Society, White House speechwriter and special assistant for national security affairs to President Clinton, and counsel to the Senate Intelligence Committee. He has an article at Republic Report, Shame, Wall Street Journal Compares Rule for Predatory Colleges to Obamacare. We're going to take a brief station break and come back and go to Alaska to talk about the 25th anniversary of the Exxon Valdez oil spill.
Teach your parents well. The children's hell will slowly go by.
Sacred land, it has seen many hands, it has wealth and gold, yet it is fragile and old enough that greedy souls just don't care to know of the changes it will confront. So speak out loud of the things you are proud, and if you love this coast, then keep it clean as it holds, cause the way that it shines may just dwindle with time, with the changes it will confront.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Shannon Moore, who's a progressive radio broadcaster in Anchorage, Alaska, who pioneered the political talk radio for women in the 49th state. Born and raised in Homer, Alaska, Shannon grew up hunting, commercial fishing, and living a rural lifestyle. And on a program, she has interviewed Alaska's political figures, including Sarah Palin, numerous times, as well as many others on the American political scene. She has an article at the Huffington Post, Exxon Spill, 25 Years of Tears. Welcome to Background Briefing, Shannon Moore.
Oh, it's lovely to be back with you. Thank you.
And it's lovely not to be talking about Sarah Palin.
Oh, Lord, help me. I know. I had Palin fatigue before any of you knew her name.
Well, I think that's maybe becoming contagious on the broader political landscape, at least one hopes. But
it's just a matter of time.
So the piece that you've written, though, at the Huffington Post, Exxon Spill, 25 Years of Tears, is really touching because you were literally fishing in the neighborhood when you got the message about the Exxon Valdez running aground. And one of the things that struck me in your article was the initial response from your crewmates was, why don't the jet fighters at Elmendorf, the big Air Force base there, why don't they burn all this oil? Was that ever considered? Because clearly millions and millions of gallons spread and seeped into the ecosystem on 1,300 miles of beaches were fouled. Was it a realistic prospect that you could have mitigated the spill by burning it?
Well, you know, it would have been really hard to ignite it because it's called moose. It's this really thick, sick crude. But I think they could have done it, and it was discussed, certainly in higher levels than on my boat. But it was funny. I had asked one of our lawmakers at one point why it wasn't burned, and he said, oh, the environmentalists would have never let us do it. And I thought, are you kidding me? You know, to talk about bombing and torching all of that oil would have been a big hairy black cloud for a long time. But what it ended up doing was so much worse.
So you stayed in touch with the fishing industry in Sitka, which is the headquarters of the herring fishing, and it's not come back. There've been pods of whales that have literally disappeared, or of orcas, I should say. Give us a sense of you know, they show pictures, and I'm sure with this 25th anniversary, we'll be seeing some pictures. The place looks beautiful, but that's only on the surface. You know, you kick over a rock, and underneath there's still oil, right?
Right. Well, the herring fishery, basically, the herring travel up, you know, the Inside Passage of Canada and across and around Alaska and all the way up, you know, so where you can see Russia from your house. Where I was at in Sitka when it happened was at the beginning of that fishery. And then it is still a vibrant fishery in Sitka, but it's a long way from Prince William Sound where this happened. But the Prince William Sound is what was completely devastated. And that herring fishery just, it doesn't exist at all. And it's never recovered in 25 years. And that was, you know, that was the thing that was so devastating for so many people in that area. I mean, before the Exxon Valdez happened, the town of Cordova never needed a women's battering shelter. They never needed, I mean, the drugs that came in, the alcoholism, the despair, like people had mortgaged their houses to buy their boats, and then there were no fish to catch. It was just this horrible cycle for years. And about three, four years into it was when the suicides really started happening. And so there's so much that hasn't recovered there.
So what is then, you think, the coverage that we're going to be getting here? What is the anniversary? It was March the 24th, 1989.
Yeah, today is the 25th anniversary.
Right. So, yeah. Frankly, I've not seen a lot. I guess people are still thinking about the BP disaster, but BP spent so much money on television propaganda suggesting that things were not only back to normal, if not better than they were before. So if you're still having ecological problems in Alaska and that otters who pick up a rock and find a clam underneath it are eating poisonous clams, this is still going on. What does it say about what we're going to be learning 25 years later about the Gulf of Mexico?
I really believe that, I mean, when I look at the technology that has changed since 1989, I wrote about this in my article, it was like, you know, I had a Mac SE Plus, right? In 1989, it was this 15-pound computer that, you know, had this, like, postcard-sized screen, and now, you know, we know what technology is able to accomplish. We're still using the same silliness, the same diapers and booms, and they just put people out there with steam cleaners, and they basically just push oil around, and everybody gets dirty, and everybody gets exposed to the carcinogens. But there has been no development in oil spill cleanup, and now they're, you know, talking about going into the Arctic, which is terrifying to me, but you know, you don't know how to clean up an oil spill. No oil spill's been cleaned up. That's not the priority. The priority for them is a PR project. And they basically have decided that all of those fines that they're going to get, that's just part of the cost of doing business. They actually save money from not, you know, they cut corners and cut corners and cut corners, and it hasn't been damaging enough to them. They haven't lost enough profit from their mistakes yet. And so I don't think things are going to change. And I think that is what is so difficult and so bitter for Alaskans who are Exxon Valdez oil spill survivors, is that nothing was learned. And when we saw what happened with BP, it's like, okay, the first thing they're going to do is lie to you about how much oil there is. Then they're going to tell you it's safe. And then they're going to tell you they're going to take care of you, which will not happen. And then they're going to say, well, aren't you lucky we spilled near water? I mean, that's basically what they learned from Exxon, was how to run the clock out on people. And they did. I mean, it took us 20 years in court, and we got paid 10 cents on the dollar. So basically what they learned from Exxon Valdez spill was how to screw the people in the Gulf. And the next spill, they're going to have even more tactics figured out.
So Shannon Moore, again, progressive radio broadcaster in Anchorage, Alaska, who pioneered the political talk radio for women in the 49th state. You just mentioned drilling in the north of Alaska, in the Arctic there. And Alaska, of course, is the huge pipeline comes up there. There's the huge Prudhoe Bay and all of that wildlife reserve that's been contentious for years. But now they're moving into the offshore, deep into the Arctic. And seems to me, just logically, you know, this is not a foolproof thing, that there's this not free of risk. And, you know, when you have a blowout like you did in the Gulf, just one oil rig blowout can cause the world's worst environmental pollution in history, which is what happened with the BP blowout. So what happens if something like that happens up in Alaska? There's nothing they can do about it, right?
You know, I've told people before, take a glass of water and put a little bit of oil in it. And then, you know, you can, like, take a paper towel and sort of get in there, and you won't get it all off the sides, but you'll get most of it out. Now put ice in the water and try to do that. It's clinging to the ice. It's over here. It's a mess. And, you know, the Coast Guard has said, we are not prepared to deal with a disaster in the Arctic. The Coast Guard does not have the resources. They do not have the manpower. In fact, the closest base, it was interesting, I was interviewing a senator about this from Alaska, who is really, he's a Democrat, Mark Begich, totally gung-ho about it, and about drilling there, because that's Alaska, right? And you know, the president has okayed this. You know, that secret Muslim, Kenyan, whatever, the worst socialist ever, and as far as I'm concerned on this issue, not a very good environmentalist, but they were all gung-ho for permitting And I said, who's going to respond in a disaster? And he said, oh, the Coast Guard. And I said, from where? And he said, Kodiak. Well, Kodiak is an island with a huge Coast Guard base here in Alaska. I said, how far away do you think that is? He said, it's 1,000 miles. I said, no, it's 1,000 miles by air, but by boat, it's 2,200 miles. You would not, I mean, Seattle is closer than the Arctic is to that base. We would never ask Kodiak, Alaska to cover, you know, Northern California or off the coast of Oregon, but we're going to ask them to respond to something that's 2,200 miles away. It's ludicrous. So they are completely not prepared, and they're admitting it, and yet the permits have gone forward. So Russia is doing the same thing right now. They're drilling their Arctic. You know, that ecosystem is so incredibly precarious and precious. And, you know, you could fly over and maybe you wouldn't even see that it was spilling for a bit. I mean, it's just, they're not ready.
Well, interesting enough, ExxonMobil has, because Russia doesn't have the technical know-how to drill in the Arctic. They're turning to ExxonMobil, and this is the only deal that Putin's got going that looks as if it could keep him in the energy business, because Ukraine is likely to eventually wean the Europeans off Russian oil and gas. And then the Chinese have found ways to get around Russia by pipelines from the stands across to China. So Putin is putting all his eggs in the basket in terms of Russia's energy future by going after the Arctic oil, and he can't do it without help from Exxon.
Well, and, you know, I saw that Russia was removed from the G8 today. And, you know, they're going to do all of these sanctions, and they're going to lock up the assets of, you know, different dignitaries or business people there. But if they really wanted to get serious, they would, I think if they really wanted to get serious with Russia, they would do the same thing they did with Iran, you know, many years ago, which was like, you can't do business in Iran. That's part of the sanction. And of course, we know, you know, I think Halliburton broke that rule and went in. But, you know, and looking at that, it's like, if they wanted to get serious, they would do that. But nobody's going to, I don't see that happening. I think the scarier entity for politically for sure, would be to go after Exxon. I think they're more afraid of going after Exxon with that sanctions deal than they would be going after Putin. And he's got an army.
Well, you won't get an argument out of me that big oil is probably more powerful than big government.
I think it's synonymous.
Right.
I mean, look at the wars that we wage and for what. And, you know, we went into Iraq and now, you know, for them, you know, at the time they really wanted to get in there. Well, Saddam controlled the oil fields. He doesn't now, but Exxon, BP, and Conoco do. That's who's running the oil fields there now. It doesn't take, and now, like you mentioned, going into Crimea, I mean, that's very obviously an oil play.
So, Shannon Moore again, progressive radio broadcaster in Anchorage, Alaska, who pioneered the political talk radio for women in the 49th state. Just to return to this beautiful, pristine sound, the Prince William Sound, that was fouled 25 years ago by 11 million gallons of crude oil. And of course,
it was more than twice that many gallons, but that's what they reported it was.
I see.
Yeah.
So that's you can safely say 22 million gallons?
Oh yeah.
And of course, yeah. This was one of the last best places on earth, as John Muir described it. How many times have you been back? Have you been back recently?
Oh, I've been back to the Sound quite a few. I was there last summer. I went out and did some work for the BBC there, and after the BP disaster, and I, you know, traveled all the way to the outside and of the sound, and went to a beach there, and I walked across the beach, and I had a shovel because I didn't dig and see how far I had to dig to get the oil out, and my boot prints filled up with oil sheen, and within 60 seconds, there was the oil sheen just on my boot prints there on the beach. And that was really devastating to see that. Within 10 minutes, I was nauseous. I had this headache that you get from being exposed to the toxins that are all there. And, you know, I don't think people realize that the life expectancy of someone that worked on the Exxon Valdez spill is 51 years old. And what they were spraying and the chemicals they were using and that exposure, it's really, it's a dispersant. It disperses oil. Well, your brain is of a similar consistency. And it eats parts of your brain to be exposed to that. 51 is young. If we, you know, that's a young life expectancy. So, you know, at the time people would, you know, my friends working on the beaches would say, God, it's so awful. You come back to the boat and you urinate and it smells just like diesel. It's like, yeah, wear a respirator. You're not allowed. If you wear a respirator, you get fired. So it's, the ramifications of an oil spill are just, well, I know what 25 years of ramifications do, and I don't know that I'm going to feel any more pleased in another 25.
Well, Shannon Moore, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Ian, thank you so much.
Again, I've been speaking with Shannon Moore, who is a progressive radio broadcaster in Anchorage, Alaska, who pioneered the political talk radio for women in the 49th state. Born and raised in Homer, Alaska, Shannon grew up hunting, commercial fishing, and living a rural lifestyle. On her program, she has interviewed Alaska's political figures, including Sarah Palin numerous times, as well as many others on the American political scene. And she has an article at the Huffington Post, Exxon Spill, 25 Years of Tears. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcast at ianmasters.com. We can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.